Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from CHP Berkshires, medical and dental care at practice locations in the Berkshires, now offering the 2025 COVID vaccine for all ages on CHP mobile clinics on the road. CHPBerkshires.org. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med. Dr. DeBrito is a surgical oncologist who specializes in the treatment of cancer or benign lesions involving the stomach, small intestine, liver, pancreas, and biliary tree, spleen, and other intra-abdominal and retroperitoneal locations. She has a special interest in managing liver metastases from colorectal cancer. Number to call here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and today we welcome back Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med, a surgical oncologist who specializes in the treatment of cancer or benign lesions involving the stomach, small intestine, liver, pancreas, and biliary tree, spleen, and other intra-abdominal and retroperitoneal locations. She has a special interest in managing liver metastases from colorectal cancer. Dr. DeBrito is certified in robotic surgery and uses a minimally invasive approach for pancreas, liver, and gastric surgeries when possible. Also worth noting, November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. You want to get in the conversation? Give us a shout. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Sandra DeBrito, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so exciting to be back.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I guess it's been about over a year now since you've been here.
Too long.
Wow. Really? Too long for you? I don't know. Most doctors don't say that, but thank you. We were talking before the show about the undertreatment. I found this fascinating, and maybe you'll relate on the air what we were talking about here. The undertreatment of liver metastases and why that is today.
So to start with, colorectal cancer is really on the rise. We know that increasing numbers of young people are being diagnosed with colorectal cancer, outpacing previous numbers by sort of a disturbing proportion. And so the screening guidelines have encouraged screening in younger patients for colorectal cancer. So instead of 50, it's 40 getting your colonoscopies. That's because that number's higher. Now, 50%, half the people diagnosed with colorectal cancer and managed for it, will either have metastatic disease, that means disease outside just the colon and rectum, at the time they're diagnosed, or develop it at some point.
Yeah.
So half the time. And, you know, in the past, a lot of practitioners were hesitant about treating advanced, what we call stage four disease that had spread to the liver or the lungs. And now in the last decade, we've come a long ways with our treatment capabilities, and really the medical oncology therapies are allowing us to do this as surgeons. And so the stage four disease, multiple metastatic lesions in the liver or even also the lungs, isn't a death sentence necessarily. It's a case-by-case basis, but there are a lot of options, and I think people just don't know. What used to be unresectable, unremovable, untreatable can now be curable from a surgical standpoint.
But I'm confused. Is it unknown from the patient standpoint or from the doctor standpoint?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think news travels slowly in the medical world, and you know the major centers were doing this work, you know, 15 years ago, and it's slowly eking out into the smaller community centers. But I think it also takes a lot of specialists, a multidisciplinary team, and so not every institution can offer this kind of care.
Tell me a little more about the things that make this jump in the last 10 years possible, new technologies or whatever.
Yeah, so it's the chemotherapy that patients are getting. The response to that chemotherapy tells us to go ahead and treat this surgically. And then we have different tools at our disposal from the liver resection standpoint. It used to be you take out the right half of the liver or the left half of the liver. And now we have really interesting and intricate intraoperative technologies that allow us to take out just small portions of the liver at a time. Called a parenchymal sparing technique. We spare as much liver as possible, and you come away with like 90% of your liver still intact. We've taken out all the small pieces of cancer.
We're joined today by Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med. How much liver do you need?
Well, that's a great question. It depends on how functional your liver is. So if you have a perfectly functional liver, I could take out 80%.
Wow.
And you would regenerate enough to survive. If you've had chemotherapy, we limit that to about 70%. So a substantial portion. If you have heavy liver disease, cirrhosis, among other things, it's less and less.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there are options. And even some centers are doing transplants for colorectal liver metastases. So the surgical management of this disease, it went from 0 to 60, and we have so many options. We just need to get the word out.
We're joined today by Dr. Sandra DeBrito. The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Did you just say that the liver, to some extent, will regenerate?
Absolutely.
Explain.
Absolutely. So it's not what people think. You don't grow it back exactly as it looked before. It's just the cells that you're left with after removing some of the liver can get larger and just do more work.
Yeah.
And so that's really also something that allows us to do this kind of work for patients. If we need to remove a large portion of the liver, we can even do techniques beforehand to grow the liver in certain locations before surgery and guarantee that their outcome is not going to suffer from a liver function standpoint.
That is so interesting. Is there a way, or is science looking at ways to stimulate the regeneration of body parts like that?
So there are a lot of different, you know, cool basic science labs out there working with regeneration from spinal nerve capacity, muscle regeneration capacity, organ regeneration capacity, because there are a lot of animal models out there that do it themselves. For example, axolotls, some Mexican salamanders, can regenerate almost their entire nervous system.
Wow.
And I only know that because I have one as a pet.
Oh.
Yeah. But from the liver standpoint, it does the job all by itself most of the time.
So interesting. Now, one of the great rock and roll musicians of the last 50, 60 years, Phil Lesh, died a couple weeks ago, bass player for the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. And I remember sometime early 2000s, he had received a full liver transplant. And when is that indicated?
Yeah, so a liver transplant can be performed for many different surgical indications or medical indications. People can develop liver failure from infections. Some infections you can catch by having a needle stick injury, for example, if you're a healthcare worker, or foodborne or a variety of hepatitis, you know, ways people get hepatitis. You could have had a blood transfusion 30 years ago, never thought much of it. Turns out you have liver failure from hepatitis. Alcoholic cirrhosis causes liver failure. And then these days we're seeing more and more patients with metabolic diseases. So like diabetes, obesity, contributing to what we used to call fatty liver disease.
Right.
But actually liver failure generated by that fatty liver disease can require a transplant.
And so now you caught my attention when you said fatty. The liver actually gets fat? Explain.
It's a little bit more complicated than that. It does like look swollen and have some of that like tissue change, but it's more the inflammation of having that metabolic syndrome with the too much fat in the system in all different locations. I mean, from the intra-abdominal standpoint, really around the organs, near the organs, that hyper-inflammatory reaction that honestly we don't know as much about as we should, paired with other things like diabetes. It can get out of control. And even, you know, for people who you wouldn't necessarily think, this is something that a lot of people are at risk for these days. You know, 40-50% of the American population is overweight or obese. It's an environmental risk factor.
We are joined today by Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll take a break here in a moment. Before we do that, however, let's talk a little bit about your expertise in robotic surgery and specifically how you use that when you're treating pancreas, liver, or various gastric surgeries.
Yeah, so the robot as a tool has been really exciting in terms of what we can deliver for patients. It's not what most people think, that a robot does the surgery by itself without you. It's more like a puppet. Like, I'm a puppeteer. I will conduct the robot arms as it was like a marionette.
But have you ever tried to run a marionette or
impossible.
Work a puppet? It's very difficult. So when you say that, it makes me a little scared. How is it you train on that without hurting somebody?
Yeah, so they have simulators that we have at Albany Med to train our residents, and you can become certified before you even finish your training at Albany Med, because it really is the new wave to do all sorts of surgeries, hernia repairs, prostatectomies, no doubt, a lot of GYN surgeries, but it's really making its way into the more complex hepatobiliary space where I work. A little bit slow to uptake because those areas are anatomically just really tight with important structures.
Yeah.
But it's happening, and I was just talking with some experts in the field on robotic liver surgery. The hospitalization length of stay is lower, back to work time is faster, on to chemotherapy time is faster for patients with cancers of the liver and pancreas. And so those are outcomes we're trying to optimize by using the technology to get patients cured faster.
Now, I've talked to a lot of great doctors on this show. Why are the outcomes better when you use robotic help?
So to be very clear, the cancer outcomes aren't necessarily better. It's that you recover from the insult to your body of a surgery faster because the incisions are smaller.
Wow.
You're not cutting somebody from the just below the breastbone to just above the pubic bone. You have small incisions throughout the abdomen that are really distributed in a way that doesn't disrupt your whole body's ability to like get up, be mobile, do the walking after surgery and all of those physical therapy things we need you to do.
Let's take a quick break here. We're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito, a surgical oncologist at Albany Med. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. So here's what I just learned in the break. Apparently, doctors, highfalutin doctors, have their own podcast universe that the rest of us can't hear. And it's very exciting to me, and it's very mysterious. Dr. DeBrito, you did a podcast.
Yes, I was helping record a podcast this morning for the Society of Surgical Oncology. That's a national group of just surgical oncologists, and we were trying to get the word out about the use of robotic surgery for liver and pancreas.
If I give you $10, can you give me the URL? I want
sure.
to check it out. All right, let's do an email here before we jump to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number, and the email is voxpop@wamc.org. Our friend Rita writes in, have there been any advances in the testing for or treatment of pancreatic cancer? Well, geez, Rita, we're just going to get there, but now you've forced the issue. What do you think, Doc?
Pancreatic cancer is still tricky. As Rita probably knows, it is one of the more deadly cancers that we face in terms of our lack of real opportunities to cure. So the five-year survival rate for pancreatic cancer is still something around 11-12%. And about 1 in 60 people will develop pancreas cancer in their lifetime, increased risk caused by smoking and also family history. But really, in terms of detection, the screening algorithms have been slow to come out because it is just so rare. And so we are recommending ultrasound done by endoscope and also imaging like an MRI for patients who are at particularly high risk. So people with family risk factors, as I mentioned, people in your family who've had pancreatic cancer or a high preponderance of other cancers. But that's really all we're working with right now. I do know also from work with the Society of Surgical Oncology that there are tests in the pipeline. There are blood tests coming down the pipeline that people are working on right now. And so my hope would be in the next 5 years, we really see those come to the clinical fore.
And just to clear something up for me before we hit the phones, if you get a bout of pancreatitis, does that make you more at risk for pancreatic cancer down the road?
Not necessarily. So one bout of acute pancreatitis caused by a gallstone, for example, very, very common, does not increase your risk. But lifelong chronic pancreatitis has been shown to demonstrate some increase of risk. It's a little bit technical.
All right. Dr. Sandra DeBrito joins us from Albany Med. One more email, then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551. Charlene writes in, has the Shield test been approved by the FDA for use in the diagnosis of or screening for colorectal cancer in Massachusetts or New York? Supposedly, it has an 83% sensitivity for detection of colorectal cancer, much better than other tests and invaluable for patients who medically cannot undergo colonoscopy procedures. And that's from Charlene.
Charlene, thank you so much for the question. You know, my knowledge about that is actually pretty limited. So in terms of like what's being approved for what's better or worse, you know, as Charlene seems to point out too, the colonoscopy is still considered the gold standard. The Cologuard type screening test, where it's a technically called a fecal occult blood test, where you just take a sample of your own stool and see if there's blood in it. Those are somewhat sensitive, but not very specific. And so those will just lead you down the road to a colonoscopy. I don't have the most up-to-date information on the Shield test, Charlene, and I'm sorry.
Why is it that only some cancers are... why can you only detect some cancers today with blood tests?
It's a matter of finding what the cancer is putting into the bloodstream, and identifying it, and then designing a test to go seek it in an relatively inexpensive way that is effective. And I think that sounds easy, but it's actually not. These cancers can be really sneaky. And I think certain tumor markers that we do check routinely for different types of cancers just really aren't specific. So, for example, one of the most common tumor markers, there's a protein that cancer makes that's in your bloodstream circulating around called CEA. It can be high in breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, pancreas cancer, biliary cancer, you name it. And it can also be high if some things are just inflamed too. Wow. And so it's really not that silver bullet that we're looking for. And the new age treatments are going to be more molecular. They're going to be more targeted to each disease process. And I think what we'll see in the next 5 or 10 years will be really different.
We're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med, a surgical oncologist. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phones. It's Troy and it's Ronnie. Ronnie, you're up.
So, doctor, I had bile duct cancer in 1990, and I had a Whipple, and they removed part of the pancreas, part of the gallbladder. You know what that does. And then I was cancer-free. A year later, I had a metastasis to the liver, and they took a small chunk of the right lobe of my liver. And then I had leucovorin 5-FU chemo for a while. And then I had another metastasis, at which time they removed the right lobe of my liver. And then I was cancer-free for over 30 years until I had gastric cancer 2 or 3 years ago and had removed the mass from my stomach, and now I'm cancer-free again. So I want to know, what are the chances, I suppose there are chances of liver cancer or metastasis coming back, another metastasis? What do you know about that?
Yeah, so Ronnie, thank you for sharing your story. That's very unique. I think, congratulations on overcoming both of those disease processes. They're both very challenging. And kudos to your team for being so aggressive. I think your demonstration of treating cancer, metastatic cancer, as a more chronic illness, like just chasing it and continuing to, weed the garden, as we say, in the liver, is the way that we're going to get a lot of people through this, particularly like we mentioned the colorectal liver metastases earlier. But there is always a risk that cancer comes back. I mean, of any type of cancer, no matter how well you think you've treated it, usually after 5 years, we call people cured. But as you've personally noted, you can still have a recurrence after that window. It's just that's the time that the literature says is the least likely that you're going to have a recurrence. And so I think, being diligent, following up with your primary care and having those surveillance sets of imaging is what's most important. And then for all of us to bear in mind that even though the old data says 5 years, people are living longer with these diseases. We may need to get the surveillance going out to 10 years.
Ronnie.
Oh, I get surveilled all the time, and I'm going to live to be 100, so.
Good for you. Thanks, Ronnie. Appreciate the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Sandra DeBrito joins us from Albany Med. Remind me, what's the Whipple procedure again?
So as Ronnie was describing, the Whipple operation developed decades and decades ago. removes the head of the pancreas. That is a common location for people to have pancreatic cancer. And the reason why we do the operation is to remove the cancer and all the associated lymphatic drainage tissue. So all the lymph nodes that you'd hear about for other cancers in that region. And it's technically complicated because the pancreas high-priced real estate. We have to reconnect three different things, the bile duct, the pancreas duct, and the stomach to make sure you can eat well, you can, you know, digest your food appropriately. It's a big operation. But even then, the morbidity and mortality, that is, the risk of complications and the risk of dying after this procedure, have dropped in the last 60 or 70 years from essentially a third of the patients dying in the 30 days around the surgery.
Oh, boy.
To something to the effect of 2-4%.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, at Albany Med, we perform the surgery relatively frequently. We're considered a high-volume center, and that's what's really been shown to make those outcomes better. Surgeons who are trained to do the procedure at high-volume centers with anesthesia teams, with nurses who are, you know, commonly taking care of this complexity, that's what makes the difference.
You know, there are a lot of bits and pieces of the human body that are tucked fairly far away. Why is the pancreas so tough to diagnose?
So what makes it tough to diagnose is sort of twofold. One, it's a long little organ. And so the cancers that come up in the head of the pancreas are arguably easier to diagnose because they block the bile duct. So we see a lot of patients coming in with jaundice, yellowing of the skin and eyes, the itchiness that goes with that. And so we're able to catch the ones that generate in that exact spot better than we are other places. So the pancreas goes all the way across the middle of the abdomen, all the way to the left side. The ones on the left side, there's no ducts to block up, and they can just get bigger and bigger and bigger and locally invade other things or spread with metastases to the liver, lungs, bones, elsewhere. And so those are really notoriously challenging to diagnose from a symptom standpoint.
We're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Vince is in Marlboro. Vince, your turn. Go ahead.
Yes. The procedures you're talking about, can this be performed on a prostate that has microscopic cancer?
Yeah, robotic surgery actually came to prostate and urology surgery relatively early, well before most general surgery, because the pelvis is such a tight spot, especially in a male. Accessing the prostate is challenging. It's another challenging organ in the middle of a bunch of blood vessels. And the robotic prostatectomy has really revolutionized the outcomes for that procedure, too. Much lower length of stay, much lower pain, much lower blood loss, just that's truly, truly been valuable. So the great question, Vince.
Vince, thanks a lot. Laser surgery is pretty cool. I mean, you can pinpoint to some extent and burn away what you need to do or, well, I don't know, cauterize it, whatever you call it. Why can't we do that with the pancreas?
So there is some role for what we would call ablation in certain different types of cancer, but the pancreas is really close to a lot of other major blood vessels and major organs that make the fallout of those types of procedures really challenging. And then also because it's behind so many other important organs, you put those organs at risk. And so with like things like radiation, targeted radiation, we're trying to minimize the risk to other structures. Laser surgery for the pancreas hasn't really taken off yet.
Interesting. Okay. Are there technological things on the horizon that are being studied, modalities that may change the game?
Absolutely. There's been a really sort of a commotion around a tool that came out of Johns Hopkins Hospital and their radiology department that uses targeted ultrasound waves to sort of blast the tumors. They've been using it in the liver, but there's a trial going on right now in Spain to use it in the pancreas as well. And so really there's no heat, there's no zapping or cauterizing like you mentioned. You just target these ultrasound waves and it just causes the little tumors to scramble.
And you can target this so that whatever's behind the pancreas is not affected by these sound waves?
Yes. It's really interesting, and it brings a new meaning to minimally invasive. This is like no needle holes for ablation, no surgeries, no cuts.
It's like
no
Star
nothing.
Trek. Almost.
I know.
Right.
I know. And I you know, I don't see that coming down in the next few years, but they're in trials now, so who knows?
Will that put you out of a job?
I don't think so.
All right, but you'd be okay either way.
There's
right?
always things that are a little too technical for those types of things.
We're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med. Number here is 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to Wine and Skill. Isaac, you're on.
Hi. About last year, my wife at age 33 was diagnosed with colorectal cancer with liver, lymph, and lung metastasis. After chemotherapy, she was actually able to qualify for an open liver surgery and the installation of what's called a hepatic arterial infusion pump. And after that, she's not cancer-free, but her liver has been cancer-free off treatment for 6 months, and she's doing great almost 2 years out when she wasn't supposed to make it even a year. We were actually encouraged to seek this treatment by a local hepatobiliary surgeon at St. Peter's, but we actually had to go all the way to Philadelphia, and she had to travel there every 2 weeks to maintain the treatment while it was active. Is this something that I know it's common at academic centers, but is this something that could potentially be available locally without having to travel for future patients?
Yeah, so the hepatic artery infusion pump is actually very niche. There are major centers, like you mentioned, that are putting those pumps in and managing them. But the problem is they really take a huge number of support staff members to manage the special pharmacists, the special nurses, and to troubleshoot, because the problems that you can get into if they don't function perfectly can be very challenging. And so I'm like super excited to hear that this treatment is working for you and your wife. That diagnosis goes along with what we were saying, that earlier and earlier diagnosis of colorectal cancer, that we're not necessarily able to explain why this is happening to people. But I think, you know, bringing a hepatic artery infusion pump to Albany Med has been a discussion. It's just a matter of manpower necessarily.
Okay, thanks a lot. Wart, you got to explain to me what the hepatic artery pump, is that what it's called? What does it do?
Yeah, so it just, you know, the surgeon implants a catheter, which is just a tube, into the hepatic artery. So it's the artery that feeds a blood supply to the liver. And then instead of getting chemotherapy into your vein and it just sort of going all willy-nilly through your whole body, you're like blasting the liver itself with a really high dose of chemotherapy. And so it's a targeted, the theory is it's a targeted access to the liver, spares toxicity to the rest of the body. So you're not getting a lot of the side effects that you would get with that dose of chemotherapy should it go elsewhere. And just treating the liver specifically with higher concentration. Really, the use right now is niche group of patients who wouldn't be able to have all of their tumors surgically removed. There's just too many. And I told you before when we were talking, we can take out a lot of different tumors and a lot of tumor burden. I'm talking like the last one I did was 13 different small tumors, but they have to be in the
take?
Right space.
How long did that take?
That one took a few hours, I think like six. And that's okay if people tolerate it well and they're accessible. But, you know, unfortunately, some of them are too deep. They're next to too many vital structures that people can't have removed.
So we will not see a preponderance of these pumps for different organs throughout the body. It's just not feasible.
So there are trials now that I also was recently hearing about for arterial delivery of other chemotherapy to other organs. It's just a matter of getting to the organ that's a challenge, and managing those pumps, like I mentioned, with all the special teams. And to really suss out whether that high-intensity chemotherapy is making a difference over what we would normally be able to give people IV. And those studies are being done right now, and Memorial Sloan Kettering is sort of the regional leader in hepatic artery infusion pumps, and so we're following them for the data.
We're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito today from Albany Med. Let's grab one more call, then we'll take a break, and then we'll go back to the phones and the emails. It's 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. DeBrito, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Bob is in Broad Almond. Bob.
Thank you. I missed the first 15 minutes. I'd like to ask about the use of CRISPR-Cas9 use in unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma. I believe that there is a synergistic effect also in using a mixture of lenvatinib and epidermal growth factor receptor, trametinib. or otherwise get MedSim. Are you familiar with these and do you use those? How are you doing those?
Yeah, so I appreciate the question, Bob. That, I will freely admit, is more of a medical oncology space. I am just the you know, knife jockey in those circumstances, for lack of a better word. Like, the medical oncologists are really leading the front on managing hepatocellular carcinoma, especially for the unresectable folks. And because it arises when the liver is already damaged in a lot of patients, we see it commonly is not able to be resected. And so I can't really speak to exactly what you described, because that is truly on the forefront of the change. But what I do know is the outcomes for hepatocellular carcinoma being treated medically are much better than they were 20 years ago. And I think it's because of the things that you're mentioning.
Bob.
Good news. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Well, we'll grab one more here. Let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
As involved with stomach cancer, and why would a mass in the unsaturated process of the pancreas show up on ultrasound and not CT scan?
I think he dropped out a little bit there, but did you get all of that?
I missed a portion. I missed what had to do with the stomach cancer, but you're talking about a part of the pancreas that's a little bit sneaky. It's called the uncinate process, sort of wraps underneath a lot of the major blood vessels. Ultrasound really is the most sensitive, the technique that we have for a lot of, actually, diseases, even though it's sort of the earliest to arise in terms of medical imaging. Ultrasound done through the stomach, that's endoscopic ultrasound, is very, very sensitive for any changes in the tissue. So it's not uncommon or unheard of for us to see things on an ultrasound that we can't see on a CT scan, just because the granularity is not good enough.
Jim, thanks for the call. We got to take a break here. 800-348-2551. We're joined by knife jockey Dr. Sandra DeBrito. Do you have that on your business card?
You should
definitely. All right, we'll be back. Sea of Tranquility. It's an old Cool and the Gang song from the 60s, I think, done by the Skinny here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. That's the number. And we're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med, who is a surgical oncologist. Let's go to Utica, and then I'll jump back to the email bag for a minute, and then we'll go back to the phones. Charles is in Utica. Hello, Charles.
Good afternoon. I would like to ask the doctor, well, first of all, let me preface it. I'm 85 years old. I was diagnosed with colorectal cancer over 5 years ago. I go to my oncologist 6 weeks in a row, one day a week, and then on the seventh, I'm off. I do not have any that has metastasized. Just one moment, please.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we got time.
Okay,
go ahead. Yep.
So it has not metastasized to my liver or kidneys, but it had to my lungs. In the 5 years I've been going, now those in my lungs have practically disappeared. But my question is, because I am diabetic, is 85 considered too ancient an age to consider any type of surgery?
Thank you for the question, Charles. That's actually a really important question that we get asked a lot. And I think we as providers need to just be aware that ageism is a thing. So not all 85s are created equal. And I wouldn't say there is an age cutoff for any type of surgery, honestly. It depends on each individual patient and the reason for surgery. So, you know, number one, congratulations on having your disappearing lung metastases. That's what we call them when they've been treated down to nothing. That happens in the liver too, and that's great. Your oncologist is clearly doing an excellent job, as are you. But I would say, you know, if you were to develop a metastasis this far out, having a surgical consideration is totally reasonable, and we will judge every candidate as they come. And so, you know, I recently did a Whipple operation on an 85-year-old gentleman, and he was in great shape, and he did well. He flew through that operation better than a lot of my patients in their 50s or 60s. You just really can't let that age direct you, and there's good evidence to show that we should be looking at the patient as a whole and not the number.
Charles.
Follow-up question, and then I'll let other people get on this.
Okay, buddy.
Is when is it decided that surgery is an item that I might consider rather than to continue with chemotherapy?
Yeah, I mean, first we have to have visible disease, and so if your disease is treated by the chemotherapy and it can't be seen, then it's impossible to take it out. But if you were to complete a treatment course at the end of that chemotherapy, be off for a while and just have one persistent little lesion, just be seen by a surgical oncologist. We have thoracic surgeons at Albany Med who trained with me at MD Anderson Cancer Center, and they'd definitely be able to talk with you about this kind of thing.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for answering my questions.
Charles, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Sandra DeBrito. Our last caller mentioned upper age limits for surgery. And I've often wondered about this. What do you do in a case where a kid has cancer of an organ and it's not done growing yet?
Yeah, fortunately for us at Albany Med, we have a beautiful pediatric hospital and pediatric surgeons who help us manage those patients. Depending on the cancer, you know, that might be in their wheelhouse. From the pediatric surgery standpoint, that's all they do is treat babies up through, you know, college-age children.
Right.
But when they get into that sort of middle ground, almost adult size, you know, teen into the college age, we work together as a team because I might have done more Whipples recently than they have, but they work with more children than I do. And so it's a multifaceted team, and that's what makes working at an academic center so special.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get right back to the phones here. One email from Joan in Salt Point. Liver question. Can you explain fatty liver disease and why a person in their 30s would have it? And that's from Joan in Salt Point.
Yeah, Joan, you know, I don't know that we necessarily know as much as we should based on how common this disease is. What I can tell you is that when we, have such a high preponderance of people with overweight and obesity, and even patients who are not necessarily overweight or obese but have high cholesterol, high lipid profiles, something that your primary care would follow, they can see that those fatty depositions is literally like as you digest the fat, it goes into your bloodstream and it has to go somewhere. We expel some of it and we store some of it. And that's, you know, evolutionarily advantageous. But now with the concentration of, you know, saturated fat, trans fat, all that in our diet, that not a lot of people can have entire control over, honestly. We get this deposition of fatty molecules throughout our bodies, and some people put it different places than others, and some people put it around their organs and even in the liver cells themselves, and that causes that inflammatory damage. We're not 100% sure why some people have it and some people manifest obesity in a different way. But what I can tell you is if you've been told you have fatty liver disease, there's ways that we can help manage it. And there's a lot of different things we can do to optimize it because it can be dangerous.
Let's go back to our phone lines with Dr. Sandra DeBrito of Albany Med. We'll go to Saugerties. And John, you're on. Hello. John.
Oh, sorry, I'm driving. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, don't get in an accident, man. Be careful.
I'm trying not to. I just wanted to really quickly say that a bunch of years ago, I had esophageal cancer, real nasty stuff. I don't recommend it at all. And I did have robotic surgery, and it was amazing. I had an over 12-hour procedure. The next morning, I was getting up, walking around. I had very little in the way of pain meds, just really Tylenol, and I was back to work within 2 weeks. So robotic surgery is amazing.
That is amazing.
Thanks, John. Especially from the esophagus standpoint, the old, not to say old fashioned, but the old fashioned way to do that surgery sometimes required 3 different major incisions on the body, in the belly, across the chest, and in the neck.
Yikes.
And instead of doing all of those large incisions, we can access it with the robot. Absolute game changer.
Well, John, thanks a lot, and drive safely. Once again, 800-348-2551. That's our telephone number. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Nancy is in Stormville, New York. Nancy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
A year ago, I was diagnosed with severe EPI of unknown origin. I am not a smoker. I do not drink. I have 3 siblings that do. My diagnosis came from somehow Aetna got me into this program with Oshi Health. and which gave me a nurse practitioner who did an MRI, blood work, and stool study, and that's how she diagnosed me. My diet is extremely limited. We're trying desperately to get me to be able to eat more, but my body just can't tolerate much food, variety of food. But can you tell me what kind of a doctor that I could go to that could help me out? A physical doctor? Who the person that I see on Ocean Health is via Zoom.
Via Zoom. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So thanks, Nancy, for asking. Pancreatic insufficiency is actually a really tricky condition to diagnose. So I'm impressed by your NP for coming up with that diagnosis. And the stool studies, like you mentioned, are exactly right. And so for the listeners, pancreatic insufficiency just highlights one other function of the pancreas. We usually think of it as dealing with the blood sugar, but it also secretes a digestive enzyme that helps you digest your food. And so if you can't secrete those enzymes, you can't digest food, and you have a lot of really uncomfortable symptoms with that. And so gastroenterology, for sure, those are the folks that deal with this the most. And so, you know, getting a gastroenterologist on your team would be really valuable. There are a couple of different medical therapies for pancreatic insufficiency. Some of them can be a little pricey, and so there's help that you can get with, you know, applying for those kinds of medicines through the gastroenterology office. I'm familiar with it because in pancreas surgery, sometimes people do develop that pancreatic insufficiency secondarily. But either way, definitely gastroenterology would be the first place to start. And there are a few different ones in the region. Take a look at the Albany Med website, and that should give you some directions.
Nancy, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. We haven't talked much about a spleen on this program today. You know, I'm a sports fan, and every now and then a football player will take a shot and have, quote-unquote, ruptured spleen. My question's for you, and they're very basic. I think you'll be okay. What does a spleen do? If it's ruptured, how do you fix it? And do you even need a spleen?
So the spleen is a little mysterious. I will say that first. So the spleen's on the left side of the body for everybody listening in. It is definitely more important in children. We know that it plays some function in the immune development and the immune processing of cells and sort of building up your immunity to different types of organisms that you'll face in your lifetime. But it's really just a blood sponge. Your blood gets filtered through there. It traps all of those possible foreign bodies and
helps
you
process
it. No, the kidney definitely doesn't. The kidney clears out your blood from waste products and then helps you pee those out.
Okay.
Totally different. You got two kidneys, one spleen.
Which comes first in line, the kidney or the spleen?
Oh, if you had to say, I want to take out one of your organs, choose. You do have two kidneys, but I'd keep those both over a spleen.
No, I don't mean in the priority. I mean in the blood flow. So in other words, is the kidney separating out the lousy stuff and then the sponge sops up the rest?
You know, technically the blood flow to the spleen is closer to the heart. So I would say the spleen first.
Spleen first.
It's not necessarily all that way.
All right. So spleen is ruptured. How do you fix it?
You take it out.
That's it.
Yeah. And unless you're a child. And the rules are for children totally different.
But you don't know why.
Well, it's because you need those antibodies. As an adult, especially the older you get, the more senescent your immune system is, the less benefit you get from having a spleen, is our understanding. And so in a patient with pancreatic cancer, for example, at the tail of the pancreas, inseparable from the spleen in most people, and also it's like a giant lymph node. It can have those tumor cells that have gone to it, and so we take out the tail of the pancreas with the spleen. We don't think much of it. You get some vaccinations as an adult, not a big deal. But in children, we go to great lengths to spare the spleen to preserve that function.
So really, in adults, we're not sure if it has any function.
And I would say it probably has a function. Here's how to say it. It has a function that we can make up for with vaccinations, and people don't really notice the difference.
Are there a lot of organs that are sort of mysterious? I mean, we know about the appendix. We've heard tonsils. I mean, what's the deal?
I mean, I think all of these things are just more complicated than we give them credit for, and we're just scratching the surface about our understanding.
It's the last time you want to be on this show, right? Okay, let's go to Bridget in Williamstown. Bridget, you're on.
Hi. I'm receiving immunotherapy for metastasized oral cancer. It's squamous cell. And been having a lot of what we're becoming to believe are side effects, rashes, psoriasis, and, you know, it goes on and on. What, you know, can you talk a little bit about the, what's the word I'm looking for? The side effects from immunotherapy and cancer drugs and, you know, I've seen now, you know, my surgical oncologist, my medical oncologist, a infectious disease, several dermatologists. So,
yeah,
you know, we're doing a lot and doing a lot of investigation to try to get to the bottom of it. But, you know, the symptoms range from inside my mouth to outside my skin.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, I think, you know, Bridget, you bring up a great point, which is immunotherapy in general. I mean, it is absolutely the next best thing for almost all cancers that we're starting to use it in. It's amazing for treatment of metastatic squamous cell, as you're talking about, for lung cancer, for melanoma, for some people with colorectal cancer have sensitivity to that. And so the more immunotherapies that arrive on the field, I think the more benefit we're going to see, but also the more side effects we're going to see. And what we're doing using immunotherapy, it's not your standard chemo like a poison. We used to, you know, just straight up chemotherapy is technically poisoning the cells. The immunotherapy ramps up your immune system to fight the cancer itself using a bunch of different signaling pathways. And again, we will say that we don't understand all of these signaling pathways and all of the places where they have effect. And so you'll give somebody a treatment. It's definitely beneficial from a cancer standpoint. And then we deal with this fallout, like you're describing, mouth sores, GI distress, you know, abdominal pain, food intolerance, skin intolerance, and how to mitigate that and focus the impact of the immunotherapy is the next big question in medical oncology. And that is on everybody's mind. Unfortunately, I don't have any great answers for how to manage that now, but it does sound like having that multidisciplinary team is really the way to go.
Bridget, thanks a lot for the call. Immunotherapy burst on the scene when? 10 years ago? 15 years ago?
I mean, probably in its really early stages with lung cancer specifically, maybe, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But really in the normal parlance and more like the last 5 years is when we're talking about it and all, how can we apply it to all these different cancers?
And science and medical science, you're convinced that you can regulate the pace of this? It seems to me if it runs out of control, you got a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not convinced that we can regulate it. But what I am convinced of is that instead of having metastatic squamous cell lung cancer that is definitively going to end your life, you're now going to live with this chronic condition of the hyper, you know, immune symptoms. And so it is a trade-off. All of these things are trade-offs. And I think as we get more target on which piece of the pathway these drugs are targeting, the less side effects we're going to see. But that takes time.
So interesting. Dr. Sandra DiBrito, Albany Med, you got about 30 seconds. I'm sure there are many things I didn't cover that you wanted to talk about. And now you have 30 seconds, so go.
No, I appreciate you giving me the time, and I appreciate all the listeners out there. If I were to say anything to you all, it's, you know, go visit your PCPs, get up to date on your screening. You can't beat screening protocols for mammograms, for colonoscopies, for those of you who need pancreatic screening, for those of you at high risk of hepatitis and HCC. You know, those screening protocols save people's lives. And if you have any inkling that you would like a second opinion ever with any doctor, just know that none of us are going to be offended when you go seek out a second opinion, because Dr. A might not heard of the latest technology Dr. B's heard of. They might do it in a different way. We are all trained at different institutions, and getting that sort of group think over the same case is how we move the field forward. And the cancer field moves so fast, we can't do it in isolation.
So great to have you on this program. I've never really had a knife jockey on the program before, so this is fantastic. Dr. Sandra DiBrito, thanks for being here. We'll see you next year.
Thank you so much.
Support comes from Stinging Nettle Apothecary, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products, incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Thanks again to Dr. Sandra DiBrito of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Really great calls and great emails today. Much appreciated. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathbun screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. All right. This was a tough topic. Anytime you talk pancreatic cancer, it can be fairly somber. I think our Knife Jockey did a great job today. But tomorrow is going to be jubilant because it's Birds with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.